tells us that the best way to pray is with devotion. And as I was thinking about it, I remembered the very first time I came to Ananda, stepped foot on the land at Ananda Village, and went to a Sunday service, just like this one. It was a life-changing event for me. I had come from a background, as many of you know, that was deeply steeped in the Christian tradition. I came from a very devout Catholic family. And for the first, I would say, 25 years of my life, in terms of having the grace to live within a spiritual context, I was deeply fortunate. My family was a devout family. We practiced what we preached, or we tried. I was surrounded by people who were devotional, and I experienced their devotion in the best possible ways. I didn't have the nightmare Catholic school experience that some people hear about. The nuns who taught me were really joyful spirits, for the most part, and they loved us. We felt their love, and yes, it was very rote as an education and very rigid and all of that, but we were saved by that experience of their devotion. And frankly, I was in a Catholic school environment all the way from kindergarten until senior in college. So I went from one spiritual community to another, to another. And it was our habit to hang out with people who were devoted to God. The parish priests were always at our house. Dinner was a time of theological discussion, where we, as children, kind of whetted our brain power against those of our elders. And from there, it was, even when I was traveling, I always ended up in this monastery or that monastery. And throughout Italy, I was surrounded, because I stayed there for a year, by my brother's friends who were all in the seminary over there. So it was kind of a lifetime of pilgrimage. And then, when I was about 25, my world changed. The world changed. You know, I'd come through the 60s relatively unmarked. I lived in the Haight-Ashbury. I saw it happen. But somehow, there was a veil between me and that. And I never tuned into the music. I liked Gregorian chant. I mean, I am an anomaly in that way. And even to this day, I feel a little bit out of it when those of my generation start talking about music. And I didn't really get into the drug scene. And I was kind of in this little bubble. But then at 25, my life took another turn. I thought I had even tried the monastery. I entered the convent. I was there for a while, and I think I drove my novice mistress crazy, because I was kind of like the Maria in Sound of Music. It wasn't a good fit, and to this day, I take all the responsibility. But the thing I remember about that was, aside from all the angst and turmoil in my own heart, trying to find my way back to God, was this one island of serenity. And that happened, you know, you have a very prescribed life in the monastery. You get up, you go to chapel, you say the office, and then you go to breakfast in prayer and you hear spiritual readings. And then you go to class, if you're a novice like I was, or a postulant, and you study the scriptures and the psalms. And then you have service, and in my case, they always put me in cleaning the bathrooms. And I think I kind of loved it, because I was by myself and I could sing, and you know how it amplifies. But I think it was meant as a punishment, I'm not sure. If you were lucky, you got to be in the kitchen and be outside in the garden and all of that. I never had that. I was in the bathroom. What I discovered, though, was my favorite time of day was right after all of the prayers in chapel in the morning, when we had about a half an hour of what they called meditation. and everything became silent. Now, there was no real meditation technique that was given to us. But instead, all of those sisters, some of us very new, some of us in the convent for many, many years, placed their minds on God. And there stole over that chapel the most amazing sense, the most amazing vibration. I had no name for it except that I became very calm, very centered, and I felt God's love. I felt it. And then it was over, and we went about our lives. And we, you know, it was a wonderful time, and it was a horrible time. And when I left the convent, I was at loose ends. I didn't know where I was going, and I didn't know what to do. And it took me 15 years until I put my foot on Ananda soil at the village and walked into that Sunday service. And this is what happened. Catholic girl, Western theology, steps into the Eastern world of Hinduism, yoga, names like Sri Yukteswar and Paramhansa Yogananda and Lahiri Mahashaya. I had no idea what they were, what they meant, that they were even people. I had no preparation for that moment in time. And I felt myself kind of tense up. I was with Janaka Devi, some of you know her. She was a student in one of my classes at the university. And she had gone on her way, found Ananda, and somehow come back into my life, God works in amazing ways, and said, why don't you come and visit me at Ananda? So that's why I was there. And before I could go too far in my feeling of tension, I heard the word Jesus. And I thought to myself, if Jesus is here, it's probably going to be okay. I didn't know. And then we began to chant. And we chanted and chanted and chanted. From the depths of our heart, we chanted. I was there with about 100 people. And all of their minds and hearts were in the same place. And the devotion that spilled up out of that moment eschewed any kind of mental template that I wanted to put on the experience. It was transcendent. And then we went into meditation. And these were people who had a technique, who had practiced that technique. And the energy came up, right up and out. And I was transported into a new life. Because in that moment, I knew. Now, the reading this morning talks about the two ways to God. There's the mental way where it's more abstract, it's jnana yoga, and then there's the way of devotion. And I'm here to say that the way of devotion probably is a lot faster. That if I had tried to sort out mentally, intellectually, everything that happened in that moment, who were these people on the altar? What was the whole philosophy behind this experience that I had within 10 minutes of time that reversed the current of 15 years where I was just floundering, looking, waiting, hoping, feeling abandoned? And it was, in a word, it was devotion. It was the devotion that I felt from the others that spilled over and my receptivity toward it. My ability to say, oh, I know what that is. I remember that from when I stopped by the chapel to say a prayer with the nuns of perpetual adoration. Or, oh, I remember that. That was happened at Father Martinelli's Mass when he finally slowed down and became absorbed in what was going on there at the altar. So I had that advantage. Now, I remember a story that was told. I had a neighbor when I lived at Ananda. And she had a tragedy happen in her life. Her husband developed ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. And he had been a very vibrant construction worker before then. But over the years, that disease just ravages you. And it was so difficult for her. And one time she tells the story, and it's printed now in Swami Kriyananda as we have known him, Asha's book, she tells the story of asking Swami, after several years of working with this great trial, of how should I pray? And Swami's answer was quick. He said, don't pray for anything. Pray with an open heart, in deep communion with God. And then everything will come from that. And she ends her telling of the story by saying, that's what she tried to do. And the last years of her marriage, when Rich was completely incapacitated, could do nothing for himself. The last time I saw him, he was wheelchair bound. He could communicate over a computer very laboriously. But the last years of their marriage, she said, were the sweetest, the very sweetest. Isn't that beautiful? And I thought to myself, what is it that we have to do to create this frame of mind, this openness? What can we do to make it better or to begin if we haven't begun? And I came to my old favorite book that I got. I love it. It's about this big. And I bought it for 10 cents at a library sale 25 years ago. It's the story of Frank Laubach, who was the Protestant missionary who went to the Philippines to work with the people there. And he tells of his great, great loneliness. There he was alone in a very strange environment. It wasn't even a Christian environment. It was a Muslim environment. And the people he wanted to teach to read as the first step toward evangelizing. And so he's there and he's alone. And he gets this idea that, well, he's not really alone. If he could realize it, God was always with him. And so he decided to, quote, practice the presence of God in every moment of his day. Much like Brother Lawrence did. And that's the other book. That cost me 15 cents at the same library sale. It was a great sale. And in his monastery, well, while he was in the kitchen with the pots and pans, he practiced the presence of God. And what was beautiful about it was that St. Lawrence said, eventually, I came to the point where I rather would be in the kitchen with the pots and pans making the meal than in the chapel with the brothers praying all their rote prayers. He said it did more. And then finally he said it made no difference at all. He was just caught up. Frank Laubach said that it was an up and down kind of business. He would keep score. He had a journal. He'd say, well, today wasn't such a good day. He said, I had lost it by breakfast. And he goes on. He said, today was pretty good. I made it all the way to lunch. And he goes on. And then finally, you know, he describes it as something that has a rhythm of its own. And some days are good, some weeks are good, some weeks are not so good, but overall, it changed his life. He one time went on the top of a hill by his house to watch sunset. And he says it had been a good day. He'd spent the whole day with God, just doing what he does, teaching little children to read, making his meals, making his bed. And yet, at the top of that hill, when the sun was setting, he was caught up in this transcendent experience of God. And when he came down from the hill, he brought that with him. And he said, what changes happened in him spilled over into the people that he was working with. And suddenly, they became a little friendly. In fact, two of the imams went around telling people, oh, listen to him. Listen to him. He's a spiritual man. They didn't really come from his tradition, but they recognized underneath all of the other things that commonality that we have, which is, as souls, we are children of God, and if we can tune into that, we're all the same. We all live in God's light. We all have access to his joy. But how to get there? Well, Frank Laubach says it takes a gentle pressure of the will. And I love the fact that he puts in the word gentle. Because sometimes we can be hard on ourselves. We can say, oh, I'm not a good person. I'm not doing very well at this. Oh, my Lord. And we look at all the times that we fail. And that's not his counsel. His counsel was little by little, step by step, valley to mountain, over and over again until the valleys become ever, ever more shallow. And then we ride the top of the horizon. And I think that that is the answer to that existential loneliness that we all feel, each in our own way, as we go through this life. Because ultimately, it is the soul's separation from God that causes us pain, no matter what you call it. If it's a dying husband, you know, if it's some other upset in your life, it's basically the soul's separation from God. And what we can do to bring God ever more vividly, ever more consciously, right next to us in every moment, will assuage that. And I'm reminded of another friend at Ananda Village, Prakash. Prakash and I had an interesting relationship. He and I came together over the New Yorker magazine. He's got a graduate degree in English from some highfalutin university, and we both enjoy the New Yorker. But Prakash tells the story on himself that he was so mental that he burned out in 4 years in front of a computer at the Village. And then he found himself taking up the job of landscaping. And he went out and bought himself a bulldozer. And he's on this bulldozer, and he's saying, he suddenly realized that if God wasn't with him, he was going to be in real deep trouble, because either that bulldozer was going to break down, or it was going to tip over, or something bad was going to happen. And so he describes what he did. He said, I brought God along with me. He was sitting right there on the chair. And he said, part of what I did was I focused my mind. I focused my mind on whatever was in front of me, especially if it was one of these really stubborn stumps that just wouldn't come out. And then he said, I suddenly took up chanting after a whole lifetime of not chanting. He can't explain it. It was simply that his spirit of readiness was right, was ripe. And he brought him along with all those old chants. And suddenly what he found was that everything was better. And the landscaping went beautifully. And I thought to myself, isn't he lucky? He's up there out in nature in those beautiful Sierra Nevada hillsides. He's by himself. I, on the other hand, am here in Silicon Valley. And I have the traffic on El Camino and on 101. And I have a third more parents in the school where I work to deal with. And life is a little hectic here. It's not like you go out onto this rolling hillsides. And I thought, is the same true of me? Will it work? Is it that kind of a formula? And it is. I know it is. Because I've had certain successes sometimes. And sometimes many days go by in between, or many hours, or many moments. But always, I can tell you, and you know this yourself, it's just a reminder that if we bring our focus back and here, and we open our hearts. I had the beautiful experience last weekend of being in a family with three little children under the age of three. I was up at the Village for the EFL, the Education for Life conference, staying with my friends, and the grandchildren were there. Now, there's this one little boy named Jaden. Jaden is about 1 1/2, and he's all boy, and he leads with his chest. He doesn't have words, so he just bulldozes through life and gets what he wants. And he's also very mechanical. So when I was grinding the coffee for lattes, Jaden was at my elbow watching, and I knew that I better keep that little coffee grinder out of his reach, because that was the next thing. So I turned around, and the next thing I know, I hear this wail. And Jaden had been in inspecting the toilet seat and the movable parts, you know how it goes up and down, and caught his fingers. And so he was hurt. So then his mother gets him. And I watched this. Now, of course, it's a scene, it's an eternal scene of motherly love. But we can never be reminded often enough. And she took him up in her arms, and he was sobbing, and the little chest was going, and she whispered sweet nothings to him. And he put his arms around her neck, and he nuzzled her, and she nursed him. And you could see this little bundle of energy get calmer and calmer and calmer. And I thought, if we could do that with Divine Mother in our hearts, then everything in our lives would be right every moment. And it's just us. It's not Divine Mother. We were there. We were wanting to help him. And he went off on his little detour. He slipped out of our eyesight. And that's what we do. We slip out on this pathway or that pathway away from Divine Mother. And she's always there running after us, trying to gather us up, trying to save us from ourselves. But we have to be receptive. And sometimes it is those little hurts that makes us receptive, or that make us receptive. I remember another story, and I'll end with this. My friend Vairagi, who since has died, lived in San Francisco. I grew up in the Haight-Ashbury, but she was down with the Ananda House when it was there in the Fillmore, and they had a restaurant and bookstore at the time. So Vairagi worked at the bookstore, but she had the late shift. Now, when I was a high school girl in San Francisco, I would take the 22 Fillmore bus home, and the 22 Fillmore went through a neighborhood that was a little bit iffy. But it was broad daylight, and we were all together, my girlfriends and I. Vairagi, on the other hand, probably was taking the 22 Fillmore to get back to her house, and it was at night, and that daylight neighborhood changed at night. So on the bus, you couldn't tell who was going to come. And she told Swami, she said she was terrified because drunks would come on the bus, and drug addicts would come on the bus. And people who obviously were criminals would come on the bus. And yet, what was she to do? Because they really needed her. There was nobody else who could take the night shift. What was she to do? And Swami said, well, he said, it is true, the work needs you. He said, I'll tell you what to do. He said, as soon as you get on that bus, you pick one person out who frightens you. And you start praying for that person. And when that person gets up and leaves the bus, you pick another person and you start praying for that person. And you pray all the way home. He said, that should do it. And so she did. And she tells what happened. She started, and all of a sudden, it was, in her words, God and Master were on the bus. And she said, it became her favorite part of day. She'd get on that bus and she prayed continuously. She was practicing the presence of God. And I guess what happens when we do practice, when we pray continuously, what does happen is the highest thing that can come from prayer. It's not just our feeling the presence of Divine Mother and Heavenly Father and friend, beloved God, but it is the spillover. It's what happens. Because you can't tell me that if God and Master were on that bus, they were on there just for Vairagi. They were on there for everyone. That must have been some bus. So I hope that we all find our own 22 Fillmore buses through life.